certainly is good to be here this evening. It's good to see you here to worship God this evening. The study that we're going to engage in this evening is one that several of you have heard before. I know because about 3 years ago in that classroom I presented these same thoughts. So those of you high school, college age, about 3 years ago, I apologize, you're going to hear something you've already heard. But one thing that Bob taught me at a very early in our studies together, he said, because I would preach at Eastside some, and I would preach at other places, and one of the things he taught me was, it's okay to preach the same lesson. It's even okay to preach the same lesson at the same place. But it's not okay to present that lesson as though it's warmed up food without having gone over it. And I assure you that I've given this topic careful study since that 3 years, and I've there are some new things. There are some things in here that I've learned since that time on this topic. We're going to be studying this evening the topic of wine and alcohol and drinking. One of the reasons why I wanted to cover that topic is that I don't remember hearing that topic discussed at length from this pulpit in the last 3, 4, 5 years. I don't remember it being presented. Now, it was presented to the high school age, and I think that's a very important age to present this topic to. But I don't remember, not since the wet-dry referendum that was where the Athens, the city, actually went wet. I don't remember hearing that. I'm not saying that's good or bad because I know it's been mentioned in passing. I remember a few lessons where that there was a point, but never an entire lesson devoted to the topic in quite a few years. So I thought it would be appropriate to discuss this and talk about it. And likewise, over the past few years, I've learned some things about this topic that really I didn't know in the past. And it really has changed my view on what God thinks about wine and what God thinks about intoxicating beverage and what are our liberties with that. And I think by the end of the lesson, you'll see our liberties are basically none with this. It is not something to be toyed with. It is poison. And the Bible uses that word poison to discuss this vile substance. And we'll look at that, and hopefully by the end of the evening, you'll see that as well. So the question we'll ask is, does the Bible condemn or condone drinking alcohol in moderation? I think that's a legitimate question. Most any reasonable student of the Bible, though I've read some who say that drunkenness is okay, but that's not a reasonable position. But most reasonable students of the Bible would say drunkenness is a sin. However, moderation is one where there's a little bit more discussion about that. And I even know brethren who would suggest that moderation is okay. And I want to, if that's your opinion, hopefully this evening, I will at least cause you to question that opinion. Hopefully, by the end of the lesson, your opinion will change because I do believe that is the truth of the matter in terms of what the Bible has to say about this topic. The wet-dry referendum, I remember driving around Athens. I never had to worry about explaining what kind of store that was. We had to go to Huntsville before I had to worry about that. My parents never had to explain that to me when we were around town. I never had to look at it on the grocery aisles, a number of things like that I never had to worry about. Now we do. And the reason I bring this point up, not to discuss politics or to suggest to anyone how they should have voted, whether they should sign a petition, I think that would be a good idea, but that's not my point. My point is that now, in this city, this substance is more easily accessible. And we need to be more aggressive in our teaching on this matter. We need to aggressively teach about the evils of alcohol. And another reason why perhaps this is something that's a particular passion of mine is that I have personal experience in dealing with the effects, both in my own life and in the lives of those I love. I've seen its effects, and I've seen the damage it's done to me. I've seen the damage it's done to those I love. I've seen the damage that those who are involved in it do to those that I love. I've seen just damage all around. It's poison. That's what it is. And hopefully we'll see that by the end of this evening. So what we're going to do is, that was the brief introduction. We're going to look at a study of the word wine in the Bible. I think this is one where that maybe most of you do know that, but a good many people who are casual Bible students don't really understand the word wine and how it's used in the Bible. By the end of this evening, you will understand that. You'll know how the word wine is used. And that's certainly something we want to look at. We're going to look very briefly at a couple of moderationist arguments. I wish we had more time for that, but we don't. But we'll look at a couple of some of the more common ones, like Jesus turned the water to wine. We'll look at that as well. And maybe actually I omitted that, but I didn't change this slide because I realized I didn't have enough time. So this bullet really doesn't apply to this lesson this evening. So we won't be able to get that. But let's look at some possible views that you could have towards alcohol. One is that you could say it's permissible in any quantity. It doesn't matter. And I've read that. I don't think that's a serious position. I think that's someone who wants to justify behavior that they want to do no matter what. That's not a real serious position, but I have read those who do hold that position. Drunkenness is sinful, but moderate drinking is not. You're going to find that in a lot of denominations, a lot of people who know just a small amount about the Bible. They know that the word wine is used. They know of the miracle in Cana. They know of a few things like that, and this will be their position. Many of these haven't really studied it seriously, but having said that, there are those who have studied this very seriously and have arrived at this position. I think those people are missing some facts and are misusing some of the words that refer to alcoholic substances in the Bible. And this is a position that I think might be the most common. And that is that moderation per se, that is, moderation in and of itself, drinking moderately without getting drunk, enjoying a beer at the end of the day, or a glass of wine with a nice meal, that kind of drinking in and of itself isn't wrong, isn't sinful, but it harms our influence as a Christian. And because of that, I'll abstain from doing that because I wouldn't want to harm my... It's a liberty I have, but it might cause someone else to stumble, so I'll abstain from that. Now, if that's your position, good. Don't give in and start drinking, but hopefully, by the end of this evening, you'll see enough evidence to convince you of this. Drinking alcohol, even moderately, is sinful. God condemns the substance, alcoholic wine. He condemns that substance itself. So those are some possible positions. Hopefully, the latter one is the one we can prove this evening. This is a quote that I read, and I think it really helps us to understand why this may be difficult to understand, particularly to a casual student of the Bible. Why is this so hard to understand? And it's a quote from John Stuart Mill. The idea, and you may not know who he is, you don't really need to know, but he's a philosopher, one that I studied some in college, liked some of what he had to say. Some of what he had to say I thought was total garbage. But nonetheless, he's the guy who said this, and I think it's worthy of our consideration in this context. He says, a generic term is always liable to become limited to a single species if people have occasion to think and speak of that species much oftener than of anything else contained in the genus. In other words, you take a word that has a general meaning, and that word is most often used to refer to a specific thing. What will happen over time is that that word, even though it has a general meaning, will come to mean only one specific thing. And that is exactly what has happened with our word wine. The meaning of the word wine has changed over time. Once, the word wine had a generic meaning. It referred to any produce from the grape. That's what the word used to mean. Even the English word at one time had that meaning. A generic meaning, but not so anymore. It doesn't have that meaning. It could refer to fermented wine. Certainly, that has been a meaning of wine throughout all the years, that it meant fermented wine. It could refer to fresh grape juice, preserved grape juice, syrup made from grapes, grape jellies, a number of things like that. You might use the word wine to include all of these substances, or really one substance in a number of forms. And that's unfortunate that in our day, we've taken one meaning of that word. And that one meaning, now that's how we use the word. When I say wine, when someone says wine, we assume that they mean fermented wine. We mean the wine that has a cork, you pop it, and you get drunk with it. That kind of wine. And that's the specific meaning that this word has taken. But as the Bible was translated, that's not the word, the meaning that the word always had. It hasn't always had that meaning. And in fact, as we're going to see, there are a number of different words in the Bible that are used to refer to wine. And we'll see that so that we can get an even better idea of how that this word is used differently in the Bible. So do keep that in mind. If there's nothing else you take from this lesson, certainly I'd like you to get that point. That when you see the word wine in the Bible, it doesn't mean fermented wine always. How do you know? You're going to look at the context and see what's being talked about. You may even have to go back and look at the original word and see what the original word is, because the translators used multiple words and they just translated it as wine. So there's more than one Hebrew word, Hebrew being the language of our Old Testament. The two most common are Yayin and Tirosh. Those are the most common. Hopefully I pronounced those right. Another thing Bob taught me is if you don't exactly know, say it confidently. And it sounds a little better that way. So Tirosh, I say it confidently. And these are the most common words that are translated wine in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Old Testament. Oinos is the one that's translated wine in the Greek New Testament. So these are three words we're going to have to look at. Now, each of these three words can refer to an unfermented substance. How do I know that? Because I read it in a dictionary? No. Because I can look at passages where these words are used and the context clearly indicates that a fermented substance is not what's under consideration. And we're going to look at that. We're going to see that in just a few moments. But before we get into that, just a few words about fermentation and preservation. We didn't really understand fermentation until Pasteur in the 1860s. But a common misconception that people have today is that if you take grape juice and you just squeeze the juice out of grapes and you set that aside and give it some time, leave it at room temperature, give it some time, it's going to turn into a drinkable wine. That is not true. It is not true. It is not true. That's not how it works. Ask anyone who dabbles in making their own wine at home if this is true. No, they have special equipment. They go through lots of trouble to make sure that it ferments correctly and to make sure that it ferments at the right temperature, at the right time. Just squeezing out grape juice and leaving it alone does not produce wine. That's not how you get it. It'll produce vinegar, but it does not produce wine. So don't get that misconception out of your mind if it's there. That's not true. It will not, over time, ferment into a drinkable wine. In Bible times, they knew better. And one of the things I'm not suggesting this evening is that in Bible times, they didn't have wine. Oh, they did. They had wine in Old Testament times and in New Testament times. And they drank it to get drunk. They did. But what I am affirming is that in Bible times, Old Testament and New Testament, they had unfermented grape juice and they enjoyed that beverage as well. And that when that substance is being referred to and translated into our Bibles, the word wine is used. That's what I want us to see. In Bible times, they knew you couldn't just leave it alone. It's difficult to control even today. Grape juice, likewise, can be preserved. Wine, with a lot of trouble, can be fermented correctly. And once it's fermented, that's another interesting thing about it. Once it's fermented and it's at the right stage, there's a lot of trouble to preserving that. You'll see how that you've seen wine racks and people build wine cellars, keep it at a certain temperature. The wine is tilted so that the cork's wet. A number of things like that are involved in preserving even fermented wine. But grape juice was actually is a little easier to preserve. One of the things they did in Bible times is they would actually boil grape juice. And what happens to a substance when you boil it? Right? Water evaporates and you're left with something thicker. If you boil it long enough, you'll get a thicker substance, a syrup. And that was a common thing they did in Old Testament times to prevent it from fermenting. Once the sugar concentration gets too high, it simply won't ferment. They could filter, they could refrigerate. They didn't have the refrigeration technologies we have today. And this last one is not something they did in Bible times. They didn't understand the chemistry well enough to know that adding sulfur dioxide would so much prevent that. But these are ways you can prevent grape juice from fermenting. It can be done. And there's a common misconception that in Bible times they knew how to preserve fermented wine, but they didn't know how to preserve grape juice. That's not true. They knew how to preserve both. They knew how to preserve both. And that is something we certainly need to keep in mind. You can preserve wine. We've talked about some of the trouble you can go to do that. But this misconception is just not true. They knew how to preserve both. I remember when I was younger, my uncle had a grapevine. And that grapevine would produce. Oh, it would produce. And from time to time, what would happen is we would get some of those grapes. And I remember my mother and my grandmother, one of the things they would do is they would take those grapes and they would take the juice from them. They would boil it and then they would put it in jars and can it, seal it tightly. A lot of ladies here still probably can other fruits like tomatoes and that kind of thing. The same was done to this grape juice. They would take it, boil it down, make grape jelly, add some sugar to it. Lots of things like that happened. But I remember that one year they decided to keep grape juice. And really all they did was boil it, put it in a jar, seal it airtight. And that kept for years, 2, 3, 4 years, stored at room temperature in our house. We didn't add any sulfur dioxide or anything to that. In Bible times, they could preserve that. Did they have the technology to boil? Certainly. Did they have the technology to keep something airtight? Sure they did. They knew how to preserve grape juice. So that misconception, we need to get out of our minds. They could preserve fermented wine and grape juice. It's not as though because it was hot and they didn't have refrigerators, they couldn't keep grape juice. That's not true. That is not true. So let's look at the words that are actually used to talk about an alcoholic substance. One of the words is yayin. Yayin is one of the Hebrew words. And this one is definitely refers to both, but it does refer to an alcoholic substance. You'll remember the story of Noah. And after the flood in chapter 9 of Genesis, Noah drank, he got drunk. The Bible says in chapter 9, verse 21, that Noah drank and got drunk. The Hebrew word there, he drank wine. What he drank was yayin. It was this substance. So clearly, yayin has, you know, sometimes it means an alcoholic substance. Yayin is a mocker. In Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 1, it just says yayin is a mocker. We'll come back to this verse a little bit later on. But it is condemned in this format. Who has woe? Those who linger long at wine, right? At yayin. This substance, yayin. This is one of the words that's used to translate wine. Good way to translate it in all those passages. That's what it was referring to, a fermented alcoholic substance. Our wine, the wine we would use, it's a similar kind of wine that was then. But yayin also had a non-alcoholic meaning from time to time. In Jacob's prophecy about Judah, let's look at that in Genesis 49 and verse 11. Jacob prophesied about Judah near the end of his life, near the end of the book of Genesis, in chapter 49 and verse 11. And the thing here is that there's this parallelism in this passage. This point is going to be made more clear in the next passages we look at. But in verse 11, he binds his donkey to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. So here we are at the context of a vine. He washed his garments in wine. That's our word, yayin. And notice what the parallel phrase there is. He washed his garments in yayin and his clothes in the blood of grapes. That's what yayin means in this passage. The blood of grapes. The juice of grapes. That's what this word means in this context. The context, I think, makes it clear that yayin is an unfermented, non-alcoholic substance, the juice of grapes. And if you look at verse 12, his eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. There's no indication at all in this text that we're considering something fermented or alcoholic. Not at all. Rather, that Judah would be blessed and would be blessed beyond measure. That's the point being made there. In prophecies against Moab, yayin is the substance that's in the wine press. Let's look at just one of those, Isaiah 16 and verse 10. I think that's the one that makes it the most clear. But if you have a wine press and you put grapes in it, and someone steps on those grapes, what comes out of those grapes? Fermented wine, ready to drink and get someone drunk? Is that what comes out of the wine press? Not so, is it? So look in Isaiah chapter 16 and we'll see how that the word yayin is used here. Isaiah 16. And this is, again, a prophecy against Moab. And one of the things God is doing is He's taking away a blessing from Moab. And one of those blessings is wine. That was a blessing they would have. So wine, when it's spoken of in an unfermented sense, is a blessing. And if you look at chapter 16 and verse 10, gladness is taken away and joy from the plentiful field. In the vineyards there will be no singing, nor will there be shouting. No treaders will tread out yayin, wine, yayin, in the presses. So when someone treads in the presses, what do you get? You get grape juice, right? You have to then take that grape juice and do something to it. Nature doesn't produce fermented wine. Men, through an art, produce fermented wine. So someone takes that out of the wine presses, it's grape juice. That's what Yahyin is referring to in this passage. Very similar in Jeremiah 48 and verse 33. Similar even in the sense that it's a prophecy against Moab. And that the wine would stop. God would cause that to cease from the wine presses. Yahyin is also gathered. I think this is interesting. If you look at Jeremiah chapter 40, Deuteronomy 28:39 makes the same point, but I think it's made a little more clearly in Jeremiah chapter 40. And let's look at verse 10 in Jeremiah 40. As for me, I will indeed dwell at Mizpah and serve the Chaldeans who come to us. But you gather wine and summer fruit and oil and put them in your vessels. Now, he's not talking about gathering bottles of wine, right? Look at the context. Gather wine and summer fruit, right? And oil. And do what? Put them in vessels. So how can you gather a liquid substance? That's kind of the point. You can't. So the text here in verse 12 uses the same language. The text here says, go and gather grapes. But that word wine is yayin. Now, grapes on the vine that you pick, are they fermented? Are they alcoholic? Will they make you drunk? No. They're not a drug at all. They're a good fruit that's pleasant to eat. I love to eat grapes. And it's a pleasant thing. A blessing. And a similar word is used, the gathering is used to refer to or wine is gathered in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 39 as well. So, clearly in these passages, and there are about 20 or 25 more, where that it is at least this clear, where that wine is the word, the English word, yayin is the Hebrew word, and the context makes it so clear that it is an unfermented substance. So get this idea out of your mind that when you see the word wine, it's talking about something that'll make you drunk. That's not the case in the Bible, always. Not at all. Another word, a quick summary of yayin. Sometimes it refers to fermented wine, and that is the most often usage. Certainly it is. But sometimes it refers to unfermented grape juice and metonymically to grapes. Is that word? That's one of the. Maybe I've been around Bob a while because he taught me to use big words sometimes too. So metonymically, it just means that it's a figure of speech where you use a word that's not really exactly the idea, but it's closely associated to the true idea. Like, has anyone ever said to Dennis Curtis, can you get us a head count? Right? Do we mean, that's metonymy when we do that. That's metonymically speaking. When we say get a head count, is he really, you know, counting heads? No, he's counting people, right? In the same way, when we talk about gathering wine, the word wine was used to refer to grapes, certainly. But the word wine was referring to an unfermented substance. So sometimes it refers to unfermented grape juice or to grapes themselves. So how do we know which substance? Whether it's something that'll make you drunk or something that's just good to eat and fresh and sweet. The context tells us that. Another word, tirosh, always refers to an unfermented substance. Sometimes even a solid. There's only one passage where it even comes into question. But in Isaiah 65 and verse 8, it talks about the cluster on the vine, and that's our word, tirosh. Now, on the vine, when you have a cluster, and yeah, let's look at that. I hear the pages turning. I'm feeling a bit rushed, but the pages are turning, so I'll turn and read that, because I do want you to see a lot of this for yourself. Isaiah 65, and in verse 8, as the new wine is found on the cluster, and so forth. The new wine is found on the cluster. That's our word, tirosh. And it refers to a solid, right? You don't find juice on a cluster. right? What's on a cluster? Those are grapes. They're solid. They have juice in them, but it's a solid substance. And it's often found in the context of produce. In terms of God pronouncing blessings on people, your corn and your new wine. And that would be your corn, your grain, and your grapes. That's a blessing God would give in both of those contexts, in Genesis 27 and Deuteronomy 7. Tiros is sometimes, but not always, translated new wine or sweet wine. But those are words that are sometimes used because it's referring clearly to grapes in most cases. I think you could argue that just about everywhere it's referring to grapes. Not even the juice of grapes, but to grapes. I think there's a lot of evidence for that. But it's translated wine. I've never called a grape a wine. I just haven't used the word that way. So when you see the word wine in the Bible, it doesn't mean a fermented substance that'll make you drunk. That's not what it means. There's one more word worthy of our consideration, and that's the word strong drink. We'll see it translated strong drink in the Bible. And the Hebrew word is shikar, and it's translated strong drink, and there couldn't be a worse way to translate this word. I can't think of a worse way, because nothing in the original Hebrew corresponds to the word strong. There's nothing there to bring those two together. It's an awful translation. And what it really means is a beverage made from anything other than grapes. That's really what this word means. So you could have some kind of palm wine or cider, maybe wine from dates. That would all be strong drink. It translated strong drink all the time. But when we say strong drink, what do you think of? Whiskey, vodka, gin, right? Those kind, and they didn't have, those were totally unknown in Bible times. They did not have the ability to distill liquors. And when we see the word strong drink, we think distilled liquor. And that's not how it was used. That's why this translation is awful for us today. It's a terrible translation of this word. There's no word strong there at all. Nothing in the original corresponds to that word. It's not referring to distilled liquor, that's for sure. It may be referring... one thing about this word, it may be referring to beer. They may have made something from grains. But you notice that word, shikar? It kind of sounds like a word we use for something sweet, that we use to make something sweet, sugar. And oddly enough, that's where our word sugar comes from. If you trace the etymology of our word sugar all the way back, it comes from this word. Yet some people insist that always shikar refers to an alcoholic beverage or a fermented substance. Most of the time it does, with about three or four exceptions. Spoken of negatively and referring to an alcoholic beverage. But it refers to beverages made from anything. Some references there, William Patton, Jim McGugan, Moses Stewart, the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. All of those use this definition. Beverages made from things other than grapes. It may not always be alcoholic. Most of the time it is. There are only three or four at most exceptions to that. Most of the time it is. And oinos, that's our Greek word. That's translated wine in the New Testament. Yayin in the Hebrew Old Testament. When you translate that Hebrew to Greek, the Septuagint, that's what LXX means on the slide. That Septuagint, when that word yayin is translated, it's usually translated as oinos. It refers to both fermented and unfermented wine. A couple of examples. Matthew chapter 9, we'll look at that briefly. Matthew chapter 9 and verse 17. And this is a parable of the wineskins that you'll know. And when you look at that, the word there is oinos. And so looking at that word oinos in this parable, I don't know of anyone who puts any other interpretation on this parable other than the wine here is referring to unfermented grape juice. So in Matthew chapter 9 and at verse 17, nor do they put new wine into old wineskins, or else the wineskins break, and the wine is spilled, and the wineskins are ruined. But they put new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved. And that's the idea there. The wine, oinos, is unfermented. And the miracle in Cana, we'll talk some more about this. But the miracle in Cana, that word wine, oinos, clearly, that's an unfermented substance. What about that? What about that water to wine? Few points I want you to keep in mind. You remember the story, right? And that's found in John chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. The story of Jesus converting the water to wine at the wedding. Here are some points we have to keep in mind before we suggest that Jesus created an alcoholic beverage. Jesus lived a completely sinless life. That's a point that I'm not willing to yield on. My faith rests on that point. I'm not willing to yield on that. Drunkenness is sinful. The Bible teaches that very, very clearly. Enabling drunkenness is sinful. To call someone to get drunk, even under the old law. Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 15. Again, remember this verse. If someone wants to suggest to you that Jesus created alcoholic wine in Cana of Galilee, remember Habakkuk 2:15. Remember that. Just etch that in your mind. Habakkuk 2 and verse 15. Woe to him who gives his neighbor strong drink. In the prophets, it was forbidden to enable someone else to get drunk. It was forbidden to do that. To give your neighbor wine to make him drunk. Forbidden. So if Jesus created alcoholic wine and made the people there drunk, then point A, that first point there, isn't true. That's not true. He committed a sin if he did that. He did not do that. It's impossible. It's unconscionable to me to suggest that. And we've already seen that the word wine can refer to an unfermented substance. So let's not assume it's referring to a fermented substance. Let's consider all the evidence. Participating in drinking parties is sinful. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3. That's sinful. Jesus did not provide more alcoholic wine to people who were already drunk at a drinking party. That did not happen. It didn't happen that way. No way. No way. Or I have to give up on that first point. And that my faith rests on that first point. That this is a vital issue here. A vital issue. Also consider the meaning of good wine. Often it's said, and the master of the feast said, usually you put out the good wine at the beginning and then bring out the bad wine later, but you've kept the good wine until now. Consider what good wine was. And I want to look at these passages in Numbers chapter 18 and verse 12. Real quickly, we'll look at these passages. Numbers chapter 18 and verse 12. So this is referring to what would be given to the priests and the Levites. Verse 12, all the best of the oil, all the best of the new wine, and the grain and their first fruits, which they offer to the Lord, I have given them to you. What was going to be given there? The best of it. And it's new wine. It's fresh. It's unfermented. Likewise, look at verse 27. And your heave offering shall be reckoned to you as though it were the grain of the threshing floor, as the fullness of the wine press. That gets back to what was really being offered to these priests. It was what was coming right out of the wine press. The fresh grape juice. That was the best of what was to be offered. That was the best wine. That's what they viewed as the best wine. When Jesus made that wine in Cana of Galilee, He made the good wine. The best wine. The freshest, sweetest wine. That's what He made. And the master of the wedding was happy to have it. Because he had run out. Good wine was considered to be fresh grape juice. Accusing Jesus of creating alcoholic wine is a very dangerous position. I can't recommend that to anyone. Very dangerous position. So let's see, do we have a contradiction? We've looked at Genesis 49 and verse 11 already, where that we have the word wine, and it's a blessing. That's how Judah was going to be blessed. His eyes would be dark with yayin, with wine. His eyes would be dark. We see other places. Remember Genesis 14 verse 18, the context there is Melchizedek. And when Abram had come back from rescuing Lot, and Melchizedek met him there, and Melchizedek gave to Abraham, he blessed him, he gave him those things. And so one of the things he gave to Abraham was wine. It was a blessing. It was indicative of the blessings that were coming from God. In Proverbs chapter 9, wine is referred to, it's being analogous to wisdom. Wisdom is you know, drink the wine of wisdom is the idea there in Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 2. It's a good thing, this wine is. It's a significant portion of God's blessing. On the other hand, Wine is an evil, wicked, sinful poison. It's the same word, oftentimes. The same word, yet it's called a sinful poison, a mocker, debauchery, treachery. It's called all those things, but it's also blessings. So what's the conclusion? It's the same word. What conclusion can we possibly draw? The only logical conclusion I can come up with is that these wines, these words are referring to different substances. It's unfermented and fermented. When it's unfermented, it's a blessing. When it's fresh grape juice, it's signifying the rich blessings God has given. When it's not, when it's condemned, it's alcoholic. That's a simple resolution to that contradiction. Very simple. Very simple. One thing that was lost on me for years, is that the substance, wine, the substance is condemned. Now, you've heard over and over, drunkenness is condemned. But the substance, wine itself, is condemned. Let's look at some examples of that. The Bible clearly and often condemns drunkenness, but many don't really understand that it condemns wine, the substance. Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 1. And I want us to look at each of these because this was like a light just turned on whenever I found these verses and was studying this. But in Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 1, one of the things I'd like you to note in Proverbs 20 and verse 1 that's not being discussed is the quantity. Not being discussed, not under consideration at all. Wine is a mocker, and strong drink is a brawler. Those are two of the words we've looked at, yayin and shikar. And whoever is led astray is by it is not wise. What's being condemned there? Drunkenness? Wine in excess? Wine, the substance, is being condemned. Hosea chapter 4 and verse 11. Whoredom and wine and new wine. Right? Those are, what do those do? They take away the heart. Take away the heart. It takes away the heart. That substance is condemned. Moreover, wine is treacherous in some translations of Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 5. In the New Testament, let's look there. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 18. Your translation is probably going to read a little differently from what we have on the overhead. But in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 18, be not drunken with wine, wherein is riot, but be filled with the Spirit. Where is this riot, this dissipation? Where is that found? In being drunk? No. If you look at the way that grammar is constructed, that riot is found in the wine. It's found in the wine. Wine is what's being condemned here. Wine is being condemned. Don't be drunk with wine, be filled with the Spirit. Proverbs 23, again, is a key passage on this. Proverbs 23. And you've read that again and again, I know many of you have, but let's look at that one more time because there are a couple of things that just stand out to me in this passage, particularly in verse 31. But you look at verse 29, who has woe, who has sorrow, who has contentions, who has complaints, and certainly excess is being discussed here. Quantity is being discussed. Those who linger long at the wine, quantity is under consideration, no doubt. I'm not disputing that at all. Those who go in search of mixed wine. But look at verse 31. How do you avoid having that woe mentioned in verse 29? Look at verse 31. Do not look at the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup. Avoid it. Stay away from it. Stay as far away from it as you can. Stay away. Don't even look at it. God doesn't use those words about just anything. But He does say flee immorality. Flee, abstain from every form of evil. Don't even look at wine. It's trouble. It's trouble. Don't even look at it. Some final thoughts. One is that 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3, I think that's worth looking at. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3 really covers drinking in all its forms. For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lewdness, lust, drunkenness. That's certainly drinking wine to excess. Drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties. Those words there, you may have banqueting in your translation. Revelries, banqueting, drinking parties. So the revelries would be the wild, loose parties. And then the banqueting would just be the social drinking. The social drinking is condemned in all its form. We spent enough time doing that. Let's be holy now, is the idea. Another thing to consider, should a Christian drink alcohol? Leviticus 10:9, alcohol is prohibited for the priest. Alcohol in Proverbs 31, wine, strong drinks, forbidden for kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, to drink wine. It's not fit for kings to do. In light of those passages, considering that we're priests and kings, ought we to be drinking wine at all? It's forbidden of priests in the Old Testament, forbidden of kings in the Old Testament. Is that fit for a Christian? Is that fitting to drink wine? Wine, the substance, is condemned throughout the Bible as an alcoholic substance. As an unfermented substance, it's a blessing. But as a fermented substance, it's condemned. It will bring nothing but trouble. Nothing but trouble. Thank you for your attention. I did go a little longer than I intended. And I appreciate your attention and bearing with me on that. But it is something that I certainly do feel passionate about because of how it's affected me in a number of ways. And I believe that God is very clear in His Word on that. The translation makes it sometimes a little unclear, but God is clear that He does not want us participating in that in any of its forms at all. It's not fit for us. It's not fit for someone who is professing godliness, who's attempting to get to heaven. It's not fit for you. It causes trouble. It will bring death. It will bring shame. In this life, as well as in the life to come. Are you here this evening and you're not a child of God? We haven't talked a lot about what you need to do. We talked some about professing holiness. Wouldn't you like to do that? Wouldn't you like to escape what this world offers? And wouldn't you like to escape the sin that has you ensnared right now? If you'd like to respond to the gospel invitation, we are here ready to help you. Let us know what we can do by coming forward while we stand and sing.